Today's program is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit rt11.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. Every week on the Farm Report, we take you on a journey through our food system. Off air, I am the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network, and I am really excited about today's show. For those of you who don't know, July is Good Beer Month, and so we thought it would be fun to take a look at the agriculture side of beer. And of course, we could not do a beer show on the Heritage Radio Network without bringing in our very own Jimmy Carbone, who hosts Beer Sessions Radio. If you are a beer fan at all, you have to check out its show. It's live every Tuesday night. Really a treasure trove of the craft beer industry. You can kind of swim the archives for anything you'd ever want to know on beer. And we're going to give you a little taste of him today. He's in the studio with us. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hi, Erin. Thanks for having me on the show.
And then also joining us by phone, some old friends from who are excited to share their new book with us, The Hop Growers Handbook, Laura Tenick and Dieter Gehring. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, Erin.
So, Lori and Dieter and I all met when I was living up at Flying Pig's Farm for the year. I worked a lot with Lori through American Farmland Trust, a great farmland conservation organization that does a lot of fun programming with us here at the studio. And then Dieter was our all-star photographer for Farm Camp. And I knew about their passion for hops, but I didn't know quite how extensive it was. And so, Dieter, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got into the hop scene.
Well, it's a long story, but the short of it is I was a home brewer about 28 years ago, and the natural extension of that, if you have any property, is to try to grow some hops. So did it as a hobby, and grew some hops up the side of the house, and first, they were hugely successful as a hobby, and about, 3-4 years ago, they started talking about this the farmhouse brewery law in New York State, and I was thinking of the possibility of changing careers from being a photographer to going into farming, and I thought hops might be a way to do it, so we started the venture then.
That's awesome, and so you guys already live on a farm that has quite a bit of history for the area. Lori, it's your parents' place, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, my family's farm was started by my great-grandfather and was originally a dairy farm and over the years transitioned into an apple orchard, which is what it is today. It's called Indian Ladder Farms, and it's in Altamont, New York. And we have a big orchard and pick your own. We grow a lot of different small fruits like raspberries and blueberries. And we have a farm store and a cafe and bakery and, have a lot of public coming here. So a few years ago, my father passed down to Dieter and I a section of the farm. And that was when we took ownership of it. You know, we'd been living here already, renting a house, you know, for some almost 25 plus years. And when we took ownership of the land, that's when we got the idea that we needed to sort of start our own farm within a farm. And that's how it all came about.
I like that, a farm within a farm. Well, before we move too much further into the hops discussion, Jimmy, I'm hoping maybe you can tell us, for those of us who are beer drinkers, how are we experiencing hops in the glass?
I mean, hops gives flavor. And actually, I read the Galley book, the Hop Growers Handbook that you guys wrote, and it's really awesome. It tells. I think I learned more about hop history than I've ever known before.
Excellent.
It's really great, right?
Guys, buy the book.
But it definitely.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy.
You know, it puts flavor in your glass. I mean, I think it's what the whole. I'm sorry, I have a sore throat. It's day 23 of July, Good Beer Month, so it's a little. But it puts flavor in your glass, and I think everyone identifies craft beer with hops. And, you know, an IPA, and I think that's really what took people away from mass-produced, you know, commercial beers without any flavor. And so I've met John Siegel from Siegel Ranch, and his family was a longtime New York hop growers as well. In the 50s, they moved out to the Pacific Northwest, and they created the Cascade Hop, and from that, Anchor Steam and Anchor Liberty. So it's like the roots of the whole craft beer, really, even though the hops were growing in the Pacific Northwest, the hop growers were from New York. So it's, you know, you can trace everything back to New York, and I think this is really exciting to have you guys with this new book.
Of course, we as New Yorkers love any story that begins with us. Well, Jimmy, also maybe you can give us a little context around the farm brewery law. What did that mean for the craft beer movement in New York State?
Well, I've been lucky, I think, from having Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I sat on the governor's, it's like the New York State craft beer working group with the Secretary of Department of Agriculture and Markets. And I went up to Albany a couple of times. And it's really amazing just to see, you know, the focus that, wow, if we think of beer as an agricultural product, as well as wine and cider and spirits, we can help upstate, we can help farmers. And just in terms of flavor, like, that's what I care about. Anyone who's making beer with New York State ingredients is making a better beer. I think they're being challenged to put something better in the glass, and I'm seeing that translate to more people. There's more breweries opening with a farm brewery license, and there's more people that want to drink, you know, real local beers.
I think that's awesome, using beer to stimulate the economy. Well, Lori, one of the things that you talk about in the book is really kind of the history of hops. Now, you take us way back to the Middle Ages, and so we're probably not going to cover all that ground in the show today, but maybe if you can nest us here in North America, because my understanding is that we used to, in the, you know, Northeast here, be really the center of the hop production for the country and maybe the world, but that's not the case today. So maybe give us a little sense of the hop scene over the last, I would say, let's put some boundaries around 150 years.
Okay. Well, New York was really the epicenter for growing hops in the United States in the late 1800s. I think it was 1880, 80% of the hops grown in the country were grown right here in New York State, many of those being grown in the area around Cooperstown. There were 40 acres of hops planted at that time, and they're producing, well, about 10,000 tons of hops a year at that point. Things sort of started to go downhill from there, largely because, you know, as we know, when you have a really big monoculture, you become vulnerable to all kinds of disease and insects that are attracted to it. And that kind of started to begin diseases, fungal diseases like downy mildew, as well as insect infestations like hop aphids, began to be a major problem. And some of the people who were growing in New York State at that time were part of the whole movement of people heading west to begin with. And there was a grower in Otsego who decided to pull up stakes and move out to Yakima, and he took his hop rhizomes with him and planted them out there. And the thing about it, you know, Dieter and I traveled to Yakima last summer. You couldn't think of a more different climate and place.
Where is Yakima?
New York to Yakima.
Where?
Pardon?
Where in the country is Yakima?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. The Yakima Valley is in Washington State.
Cool.
And it's a high elevation desert. And there's really almost no rainfall there at all. And all of the water for the plants comes from the Yakima River, which is basically snowmelt coming down from the Cascade Mountains. And the extreme dryness of the Yakima Valley took away a lot of the problems that were brought about by moisture here in New York State. And they were as long as they had the sufficient water supply, because hops require an enormous amount of water. They had this enormous amount of water they could put in the ground, but none coming from the sky. So it turned out to be a really good environment for hops. Mm-hmm. And that's how it kind of took off from there. And that is now the epicenter of hop production in the United States.
But we are seeing a resurgence here in the Northeast. I mean, can we give you guys some credit for that?
Well, I don't know if we can personally take credit. There are a lot of people involved in this, so, but we'll take a little.
Well, Dieter, maybe you can help us understand the hop plant. I mean, I was surprised that they, you know, grow to be upwards of 18 feet tall. They take over 3 years to reach kind of production stages. So maybe you can give us a little sense of a, like, okay, I'm moving up, you know, next door to you guys, and I want to start my own hop operation. What does that kind of look like, and what kind of time frame am I in for?
Well, you're in for a kind of a long time frame. You're in for a rather large financial investment to get the infrastructure up for putting up any kind of, you know, commercial hop yard. The hop plant's a perennial. It does take about 3 years to get to full maturity. You will get, you know, some cones for making beer the first couple of years, but it really takes off. People that, the way I explain it is, people that are already in the apple orchard business or grapes, they're kind of set up for this kind of growing this type of plant. You have to have a very robust trellis system. If you let a hop grow, it'll grow to 30 feet tall.
Whoa.
Yeah, so most trellising is between 18 and 20 feet. That's you get good production at that height, and from a practical standpoint of equipment and so on for harvesting, you don't want to be much higher than that. And also, since I'm afraid of heights, I try to keep my yards between 16 and 18 feet. So maybe I'm losing a little production, but, you know, it's worth it to me. You have to have a good source of water. Like Lori said, they require a tremendous amount of water. I mean, they want an inch and a half of rain a week. You have to have a good way to supply nitrogen to them. They're a very, very nitrogen intensive plant, and they require a fair amount of care, as we found out. It's one of those things, like, you know, if you grow tomatoes as a hobby, boy, you grow some beautiful tomatoes. And then try to farm them and sell them to the farmer's market, and all of a sudden you discover that it's farming. and you have disease pressure, and you find out all the problems along the way. And then that was part of the reason that, you know, we ended up writing the book, was because when we were out there trying to find out, you know, oh my God, what is this insect that's eating everything? And you go to the internet, and as you do for everything, you
right.
can find it. And our main source at this point is, you know, information from Pacific Northwest. Well, eating plants and destroying them a couple of years ago were Japanese beetles. So we went to, you know, the manual from Oregon State University, and we looked it up, and there was no page, you know, for Japanese beetles, and we inquired about it.
Wow.
And that's because they don't have them.
So you guys are, like, in many ways, like, writing some of the first resources that have ever been published for hops in this area.
Well, I think what Lori was able to do was to really pull everything together from, you know, the University of Vermont has been kind of a leader in this. They started early on, and Cornell has, you know, been at it for a while too. But she did a great job of putting it all in one place where you can just pick this up. As Steve Miller from Cornell kind of called it, he says, kind of a cookbook, and there never has been for hops.
Well, kind of, in that kind of cooking space, actually, Lori, I wanted to ask you, you did include a little bit of info on, like, other maybe ancient uses for hops. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about hops making you sleepy or brewer's droop.
Yeah, well, hops were originally not used in beer way back when in the, you know, ancient times. They were a medicinal wild plant. And they were used. There's a lot of really strong chemical compounds in hops, and when you smell hops in the beer, you smell that really intense odor. Well, that's sort of demonstrative of all of the intense chemicals that are in there. And there is a compound in the hop that is a soporific, which means that it makes you sleepy. It has been traditionally used to help with insomnia over, centuries. And some of the earliest references to hops are in medicinal books that were written in, like monasteries and so on, about the various things you can use hops for. They also have a compound that is very similar to estrogen. And for that reason, they are can be used medicinally to relieve some of the symptoms that women may experience, with irregular estrogen, for example, during menopause. And another thing is, because of estrogen, I don't know if anybody has heard the folk remedy for when breastfeeding to make milk come down for the baby to nurse is for the nursing mother to drink a beer, and that helps the milk flow. And that's because of this estrogen-type compound in the hops. That's the effect that it has. All of those are desirable effects, and it can in men have undesirable effects that may result from too much estrogen-like substances. And there is a theory that too much exposure to some of these compounds in hops can cause impotence in men. There was also a theory that most of the people, when hops used to be picked by hand, the overwhelming majority of the pickers were women and children. The thinking was that men avoided that activity directly because it would cause them to grow breasts.
What?
Now, I'm not sure if all this is actually true, but this is some of the folklore and things that I found during the research for the book.
But not something we need to worry about drinking beer, right?
Well, I think alcohol also plays a role in at least some of these problems. So it's hard to dissect with the hops or the alcohol at a certain stage, I guess.
No, that makes sense. Well, Jimmy, I'm wondering, when we're thinking about, the ingredients of beer, it's pretty simple: water, hops, and some type of malted barley, more or less, and then maybe a few other components for different types of beer. And I know that when we're thinking about things from an agriculture standpoint, hops definitely have gotten a lot of attention in that ag conversation, especially with this renaissance here in the Northeast. But as a kind of, cash crop or percentage of volume, maybe can you orient us, how do we think about hops when we're making a beer? Is it like equal parts barley, hop, water, or how much hop is in a beer?
I think that from my understanding, hops are like the spice trade. They're worth a lot, and they give a lot of flavor, and the price goes up. I think that in terms of the actual quantities of ingredients, it's really water and the barley or the other grains. So that's really where the real need is. I know, like with June Russell and the Regional Grains Project, and a lot of what's going on in New York State is just even try to figure out what grains are going to grow well in New York State, to make beer and spirits is a bigger issue. So the hops are kind of an easy thing to tackle, and I know that like Steve Miller at Cornell, they've been doing that for a while. So I think you can go out and plant like a half acre of hops and do fairly well with that. And then you really need to getting into, I think a big question for these guys is, is anyone now in New York State making any hop harvesting equipment? Because that seemed to be the holdup. Because once you get to a certain scale, like there's some cool things in this book about people that used to go up to the hop country for working vacations and harvest hops and then drink at night. So this hop culture is really cool. Like in southern France, you would have students from Paris go down and harvest grapes. And I would love to see that come back. Get all the students from New York and go up and harvest hops. But yeah, so hops it's like the spice.
Okay.
And we've had on Joe and Dennis Fisher, they're homebrewers in Maine. They wrote a great book called Homebrewer's Garden. And they were actually growing other things like dandelion that provide a similar flavor or bitterness that working people, farmers have used over the years, because at one point hops were for the nobility or they were taxed. So there's other things you can use to provide flavor and spice.
So Dieter, kind of on that note, when we're looking at infrastructure for hop production, What is the lay of the land, and have you noticed changes over the years?
Hop picking is laborious, the hops themselves have these things on the vines. They're called brycombs, and they scratch you. And if you look at any of the old pictures of hop picking from, you know, the 1800s, they're all wearing long sleeves and hats and stuff. And you have to remember, this is August and September in upstate New York. It's hot. But they're covered up because you get what's called the kiss of the hop on you, and it leaves a big scratch on you. So the picking, hand picking is difficult, and as we found out, once you get up to this, you know, size, you know, you have hop parties every year, and you get a keg of beer and your friends come over and pick hops, but one hop plant is about 40 pounds, and it takes about 1 man-hour to pick it. So if you're at 1,000 plants, after a couple of years, you don't have enough friends to come over anymore. So you have to go mechanization. And unfortunately, you know, because of the economy of scale, the Pacific Northwest has all the hop picking equipment, and their machines are, you know, they're gigantic. You know, they're like $1 million, and they take up an entire interior of a, you know, gigantic, you know, warehouse building. And so we were sort of in a problem here in New York State, where there were a few people making, you know, trying their hand at making some small pickers and stuff. And UVM got some grant money to design a picking machine. But ultimately, we needed to get the equipment from Europe, and we just took delivery this past January of what's called a Wolf harvester. Unfortunately, they don't make these machines anymore, so we had to go through a broker and get a used machine. And anybody of any size at this point is really buying one. In fact, in New York State, I think we're up to 16 machines. And what we're offering now at our farm, because there are a lot of people in the same boat, we're becoming this year a regional hop picking facility. Hops need to be picked right away. So when you cut them, you have about an hour from the time that they leave the yard to being processed and picked and put in the dryer, and they become unstable. And so we've got about 10 farms, I think we're up to now, because everybody planted hops, you know, 2 and 3 years ago. Well, now if you put in a half acre of hops or better, you have a problem if you can't pick them and dry them. So there are a lot of people, you know, counting on us. And I know that there's a picking facility in Oneonta that has two wolves. And a person who bought the sister machine of ours is out in Syracuse. And they've got about 10 farms looking to, you know, get them going too.
Wow, that's so interesting and so similar to what we hear from other types of agriculture, whereas, you know, one of the byproducts as things continue to consolidate and farms get larger, that it doesn't make sense for companies to be producing machines for small scale facilities, for small harvesting. And I know so many farmers, particular vegetable farmers, who really get creative with producing their own machinery or adapting other things or creating their own tools and adding to their skill sets as kind of like welders and small machinists. It's really wild.
Right. Well, you know, like our hop harvester is from 1973.
Older than me.
We're also growing barley here on the farm, but we're only doing it on a very small scale. And because we're in Albany County, we don't have a lot of farms anymore around us. And so any of the bigger farms, the combines are too big to transport over the road to get to us. So, but we're dealing with antiques. So, you know, we have a 1948 combine and we have a 1962 combine that are small enough that we can pull behind a tractor. So our hop harvester is really our newest piece of equipment at 73.
That's wild. We are gonna, I'm gonna ask you guys to hold tight for just a second. We're gonna take a short station break and we will come back with more hop talk. So hang tight.
Born from discord and harmonies, raised by the rays of the falling sun, cruel that rage about your cupid makes laugh the killer.
This is Odetta Hartman. Song is called Daphne and Apollo. We will be right back.
Shoulders and low to have anything to do with men. Love fears to follow Sorrento's. And so I tip a gold to Tipperary.
Hi, I'm Harold McGee. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a nonprofit organization, which means they depend on the support of listeners like you and like me. The best way you can support this program and others like it is to visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org, as I have, and click the donate button to become a member today, as I have. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
All right, we are back. Harold McGee is just the coolest guy. I'm such a fan. If you have not read his book on food and cooking, stop what you're doing. Go on to the internet. First, of course, purchase the Hop Growers Handbook by Laurie and Dieter. But right after that, yeah, you know, on food and cooking is an essential in anyone's home kitchen. Well, I want to talk, Dieter, you kind of touched on this before the break, about the volatility of hops after harvest. So most hops don't make it, don't go fresh into beer. There's a whole nother set of things that happen after the harvest. And can you walk us through that?
Well, there's hops are used in two forms. After they're dried, which, you know, is basically what you're doing is you're stabilizing the hop and the lupulin inside, which is really what the brewers want, the brewer's gold. And then in most cases, it's baled at that point, so it's compressed. But not too tight as to not, you know, damage the lupulin. And then it's put into cold storage. And some brewers use hops as whole cones. And in fact, if you know Sierra Nevada, they still do only whole cone brewing. But most modern brewing equipment, especially on smaller scale for craft brewers, is designed to use pellets. You need to pelletize, which is another step in the process, which we are not doing this year. We're farming that out to another place that will do all our pelletizing for us. What pelletizing does is it makes it look, you know, like, oh, I don't know, like if you've ever had a rabbit or a guinea pig, you know, the feed you feed that, it makes it look kind of like those kind of pellets. And they're put into Mylar bags and they're vacuum flushed. It makes them much more stable and easier to use for the brewer. So that's yet another step that needs to be, you know, established in New York State. We have about, I think, 4 pelletizing facilities at this point around the state.
So, and Jimmy, on the kind of beer making end of things, you know, what are you hearing from brewers about how they want their hops?
Well, we've been lucky the last few years with New York City Beer Week. Like Kelly Taylor, who's the president of the New York City Brewers Guild, they've really gotten behind doing this year it was a state malt and state hop beer, smash beer. So that's really it's encouraging the brewers to work with the local ingredients. And exactly what Dieter said is that they're used to working with hop pellets, but when you're getting these fresh hops in, or even, you know, other hops from New York State that might be processed differently, the batch for them takes a little more care. I think it makes a better beer, and I think there's nothing wrong with taking a little more time. It's not as profitable. I think that, you know, breweries are set up to kind of knock out product,
right?
But I think that anything that forces them to stop and take a little more time with the product does make a better beer. So I think that by using any local ingredients or the wet hops, it's more challenging. But I think that everyone wants that beer and will pay more.
So it's kind of like when you go to the farmer's market in the middle of the summer and the recipe calls for one tomato, but there's like 18 different kinds of tomatoes and 18 different sizes. So you, as a cook following a recipe, have to, you know, take a moment to like make some editorial decisions there.
Yeah, I mean, sure, different than just in an industrially canned tomato sauce that they always have the same tomatoes.
Everything's
so, for
looking
sure.
The same. Well, one of the things that came up in the book is kind of talking about the quote, in quotes, new normal of climate, and kind of what growing season looks like, and we think about sunshine and rainfall and the variation in heat and the kind of length of growing seasons. And I want to talk a little bit about that, but I want to kind of frame it in this context. One of the things that I find so interesting about the craft beer movement is the brewers, the drinkers, the people kind of leading this movement become de facto environmentalists. As we said earlier in the show, if the primary ingredients of beer are hops and barley and water, obviously having a really clean, safe water source is a concern for brewers, in addition to dealing very directly in these agriculture products. So, Lori, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about what you guys have seen, having been in the same location for a couple of decades at this point, with regards to kind of climate and how you think that being a beer maker, a beer drinker, and now a hop grower has informed your thinking with regards to the environment.
Well, you know, we, of course, Dieter and I have always been strong environmentalists. One thing I think is interesting of farmers in general, conventional farmers aren't always necessarily considered environmentalists, but in fact, and to a certain extent, many of them really are, because, as you say, farmers are relying on the quality of the water and the soil to produce their crops. The other thing I think is interesting is, you know, some of the more conservative conventional farmers, many of their peers may be climate change deniers, but you often don't see that amongst the farmers themselves, because they are so closely tracking the weather. It's quite clear to them that the climate is, in fact, changing. And originally, farmers said, oh, well, global warming is a good thing because we're going to have a longer growing season. And it, for farmers in the Northeast, that's going to be economically a good thing. But we've all seen in the past several years that what's really happening is the severe weather patterns that are coming with the incremental warming of the climate. And that's what's really causing big trouble for farmers. You know, one advantage we have in the Northeast in terms of water is we have a lot of it, whereas agriculture in the West is suffering from a drought. And hop growers in the arid regions are relying on snowmelt and to water their crops, as I mentioned earlier. And as the snow stops falling, it ultimately stops melting, and they're looking at, you know, where are they going to get their water from. There's so many things in agriculture, you know, in one way it's good, in another way it's bad. Here we have a lot of water, but some of the severe rainstorms we've been getting are just really challenging for hop production. I mean, we will sit down and get, like, 2 inches of rain in half an hour, and, you know, they say, there's a thing about hops where they like to drink a lot of water, but they don't want to be wet. And for a lot of standing water to be on the leaves of the hop plant is a very dangerous situation, because that's when the fungal diseases move through water, particularly downy mildew, moves along the surface of the plant through the water and takes that opportunity to infiltrate the plant. And that's one of the most serious diseases that we're facing here in the Northeast with the hops. So, you know, that's kind of a long rambling statement about water, but there's a lot of different ways to look at it and ways it's impacting us. I certainly, when people plant hops, because they are a permanent crop, they do require so much water. You really need to make sure that you have a very strong and ample source of water, whether it's a pond or whether it's groundwater, something that's constantly replenishing. And, you know, this is a major issue for farmers everywhere, but particularly for hops.
For hop growing, yeah. Well, Jimmy, anything to add on that note? I mean, as beer brewers and beer drinkers playing a role in our agricultural landscape?
Yeah, I think that, you know, people want to drink flavor, but they have a sentiment about wanting to support local. But I think what's really cool is that even up around you guys, there's some new breweries that are really great. Maybe we can talk about the beer scene up there. I know you've got Suarez Family Brewing and From the Ground Brewing, and you guys at Indian Ladder. I mean, that's exciting that there's breweries springing up around, you know, where you guys are growing hops, malt, and if there's any malt facilities too.
Yeah, what are you seeing?
We're hoping there's going to be a malt facility. Right now we're driving 2.5 hours to have our stuff malted, so it's, you know, we'd like to have something local. But, yeah, we're very excited about, you know, some of the other breweries that are coming on. The Suarez Family Brewery, we're good friends with them. And we were just talking with Dan last week, and he wants us to grow buckwheat for him. So hopefully we'll be able to do that for them.
Lots of experimenting. Well, on that note, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the beers that you guys are producing?
Well, we're just in the experimental phase. We don't have our licensing yet. We're very close, apparently, but we're probably, for the most part, going to work on sours and fruit beers. We are on a 300-acre apple orchard with raspberries, blueberries, and strawberries, and all those. So we're working on those kind of things, and of course we'll have IPA as well, because we are a hop farm. But we've been doing a lot of experimentation with that, and we've been actually experimenting because we're doing cider as well, because we do have a cider press on the farm. So we've been experimenting with some barrel aged ciders and some dry hopping of ciders and adding blueberries to ciders. So we're very excited when we can actually sell some of these products to the public. I think what the test batches have been being very well received, so we're very excited.
So maybe something to look forward to if we come up your way to help with the hop harvest.
That's right.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I want to kind of round out the discussion, taking us way out and talking a little bit about policy and how I think there's been some really interesting things coming out of the governor's office with regards to incentivizing and promoting the craft beer movement. And I'm wondering if, maybe starting with you, Jimmy, you could talk a little bit about what that state level support has meant for the craft beer community.
I mean, number one, it's just been they streamlined the state liquor authority, which was long overdue. A lot of the rules went back to the end of Prohibition, and the current administration has just gone and cleaned up a lot of outdated rules and regulations, and it's more streamlined. You can do a lot of license processing online. But number one, it's the farm brewery license. I mean, it's just an incentive to, and starting really low. The goals are very, I think you have to purchase 10% of your ingredients from New York State at this point, and there's targets that are going to be hit. But the incentive is, buy from New York State farms and farm products, and you can sell the products. And the rules are very liberal in terms of selling out of your brewery as a tasting room, and they've even modified it so a lot of just smaller microbreweries can now set up tap rooms within their brewery. So it's come a long way, but I think the goal is that everyone wants to drink local. There's room enough for a small brewery in every town and every community. In New York City, I think there could be a brew pub on every corner like there is a coffee bar.
Yeah, no, I like that, and I do kind of the things that you're pointing out there as where it being kind of sounds super realistic in scope. It sounds like they had some people from the community at the table when they were drafting kind of what exactly this program was going to look like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the New York State Brewers Association has taken the lead for a long time. It was Dave Kadaleski, who's in Syracuse with Empire, and they've grown, and they really had Albany's ear. And now Dave Kadaleski is also, he's opening a brewery on a farm property as well. So everyone's like, everyone's walking the talk, right?
Yeah.
Well, walking the walk.
Turning it over to, I think we'll turn it over to you, Dieter, and then Lori. And what I would love for you guys to share is, I know, Dieter, you had mentioned you are, waiting for some licensing, but if there's other areas that kind of state policies are making your work easier or harder, and then handing it over to Laura to kind of wrap us up, because I know you work so closely with American Farmland Trust and how that organization's work might kind of dovetail into creating a better beer industry here in New York State. But Dieter, we'll start with you.
Well, the licensing as far as the state went for us went very quickly. It was very easy. We sort of got hung up a little bit in the licensing with the not really the license, it was the permit to manufacture cider and beer, because in some cases the state is more progressive, changing the laws, and the federal government has that we were having an issue with. The federal government doesn't like the idea of a cidery inside a brewery or a brewery inside of a cidery. So we've had to do some machinations on the farm here in order to kind of appease them. That took many months, but I think we're through that phase, and so we're just basically waiting for that permit, and we'll walk it over to the SLA, and then I think we're good to go.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah. But, the state's been great, and it was really, you know, we were just going to be a production hop farm, but, you know, value-added products for a farm is where it's at, and what's the best value-added product, you know, it's beer and cider.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Well, Lori, we'll let you have the last word here.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I think in terms of Governor Cuomo's relationship to agriculture, it's been interesting to see it develop over the years. You know, he's essentially an urban person who hasn't spent a lot of time on farms. I think the most time I've seen Governor Cuomo on farms was during situations like Hurricane Irene, when he was on farms that had been devastated by severe weather, and that was part of his sort of evolution of his thinking, and that in Superstorm Sandy about publicly acknowledging that climate change is happening. In terms of his approach towards agriculture, I think everything is really seen through the lens of economic development. And, you know, agriculture is really the activity that lies at the foundation of all economies around the world, and this one is no different. So I think that it makes a lot of sense. Helping agriculture through fostering economic development is a natural fit, and this was what the farm brewery law has done. It's sort of, Cuomo has focused on the intersection of agriculture, economic development, and tourism, and I think that this craft beverage and farm-based beverage industry is something that's going to work extremely well. I see huge potential, even internationally for these products coming out of New York State.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you guys so much. It's been such a pleasure having you on.
Thanks,
Aaron.
So I know you guys are going to want to follow up more with these amazing guests. You can find Jimmy here on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday night as host of Beer Sessions Radio. Also follow him on Twitter at Jimmy Pot and Pan. And any other recs for July Beer Month, Jimmy? What should people be putting on their calendar?
Well, it's winding down. Next Wednesday, big part of July Good Beer Month is recognizing the small independently owned craft beer bars in the area. So on July 29th at Jimmy's number 43, we're going to give out the 7th annual Good Beer Seal Awards. And on July 30th, Edible Brooklyn hosts their annual Good Beer event.
And I do want to give a little shout out to the Good Beer Passport. Definitely, if you are in the New York City area, Google that. A really cheap way. I think it's like $37 for 35 pints of beer at great breweries and bars all across the boroughs.
And they're making a donation to Heritage Radio Network,
and
too.
And they're supporting us.
Good
so
beer passport.
Drink beer and support Heritage Radio Network. Duh. Also, of course, check out this amazing book by Lori and Dieter. It's called, again, The Hop Grower's Handbook, The Essential Guide for Sustainable Small-Scale Production for Home and Market, brought to you by Chelsea Green, one of my favorite publishers to work with. And you can find it wherever great books are sold. Want to give a shout-out to Jack in the booth, who's engineered my show today. If you didn't catch that, the music break was provided by Odetta Hartman. She's got a new album out. It is awesome. And, of course, our theme song, as always, is by Obey City. Definitely check them. Follow them on Twitter and download their music. Thank you guys for tuning in. If you like what you heard, tell your friends. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Definitely get in touch. You can tweet me directly. It's Aaron_Fairbanks. And stay tuned. Just after the show here, we have a little teaser clip with Chef Marco Canora and some amazing snack hacks. Checking out another great show on the Heritage Radio Network, The Food Scene. A little taste, and you get to find out what cacio pepe is. So hang tight. That's coming right up.
There's so much misinformation out there, and And everybody thinks that eating well needs to be surrounded with deprivation. And it's like, it's not deprivation at all. Like, I'm a fucking hedonist.
Chef Marco Canora shares some snack hacks on episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel.
I love food. I eat food like crazy. I don't need to be hungry to eat food. It is just like a huge part of my life. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid of this idea of eating well because they think that you turn your back on all that stuff. And no, it doesn't mean you turn your back on loving food. It just means you have to educate yourself and think differently about it.
So when you think of popcorn, do you instantly think, oh, that's fiber. That's going to clear me out.
Yeah, you know, I think about popcorn and then I say, well, let's make sure I put the right fat on it. And let's make sure, you know, I'm getting a good quality popcorn that's not some kind of highly mass-produced GMO popcorn. And then it's great popcorn, and I'll grate some really good pecorino cheese on it and put a boatload of black pepper on it and put a big hunk of really good grass-fed butter on it and some nice sea salt. And, man, it's fucking delicious, decadent popcorn that I could eat a tub of it until I'm sick. And I'm not going to feel so bad about it, right?
Because of you now cacio e pepeing something is like a verb in our house.
Right.
We always have that hunk of pecorino.
This was an excerpt from episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel. Did you like it? The Food Scene episodes are available on our website or on iTunes. Dig in for more. This piece was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.